This is Meredith for Real, the Curious Introvert, and I'm Meredith. Here, we explore the taboo questions that people think but don't ask out loud. Questions that need nuanced answers unavailable even to Google. My mission, and yours if you choose to accept it, is to inspire curiosity within yourself and the world around you. Each episode is different, so bring your ADD and your earbuds and have a look around. Before we dive in, I want to say that if you like giving your opinion and getting free stuff, you're officially invited to join my private Facebook group. You can search MFR Curious Insiders or just click the link in the episode description to request to join. Oh my gosh, y'all are going to love this guest. In that Insiders Facebook group I mentioned, you told me that you want to hear more stories. And thankfully, this guest is a master storyteller, and he's got quite the collection to tell. You'll hear about the Boy Scout parade that became the race relations reality check, his first encounter with a Klansman, and how jazz music led to an unlikely friendship and also a pretty intense meeting in a hotel room. He also comments on cancel culture and our educational system. I'm telling you, it's good. If you end up liking this episode, you'll also like the one I did with a man who voted for Obama and then joined the KKK. That's episode 134. All right, friends, keep it curious. Most people have never attended a KKK rally, shaken hands with a grand wizard, or felt threatened by America's growing racial diversity. But, like one rusty wrench in a toolbox, racism can spread even among people who've never met someone different than them. But how can they hate someone they've never met? My next guest is a Black man who, as a child, wondered this very same thing. He grew up to be an incredibly talented musician, but some might also call him an expert connector. He spent a lifetime seeking friendship with members of the KKK. He has been so adept at this friendship that he inspired over 200 Klansmen to give up their robes. And today he's going to share how this came about and his hopes for real progress in America. Musician, race reconciliator, conversational virtuoso, Daryl Davis. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you for having me, Meredith. I really appreciate it.
Now, your dad was Foreign Service, right? So you grew up moving a lot, different countries. You were hanging out with kids from all different backgrounds. So you were pretty sheltered from at least overt acts of racism until you were 10 years old. Can you share what happened at the Boy Scout parade?
Sure. How it works is, you know, you get to assign to a country with the American Embassy for 2 years, and then you come back home. You're here for maybe a year, and then you're back overseas to another foreign country for 2 years. So I first started traveling at the age of 3. And 1961, I just turned 66 years of age. So my first exposure to school was overseas. Kindergarten, first grade, third grade, fifth grade, seventh grade, all in different countries. And back home in between grades, right? My classmates overseas were from all over the world. Anybody who had an embassy where we had the American embassy, all of their kids went to the same school. So my classmates were from all over the world, as I said. That's what I was accustomed to. That was my baseline for what school was supposed to be. But every time I would return home, I was either in all Black schools or Black and white schools, meaning the still segregated or the newly integrated. And there was not the amount of diversity in my classrooms that I had overseas or that we have today in this country. So as you pointed out, one time I came home, I was age 10 in the fourth grade, 1968. In this particular time, I was one of two Black kids in the entire school, myself in fourth grade, and there was a little girl in second grade. So consequently, all of my friends were fourth and fifth graders, and they all were white. And several of my male friends were members of the Cub Scouts, and they invited me to join, which I did. And we had a parade, which included the Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts, Brownies, 4-H Club, and some other organizations. The streets were blocked off. Sidewalks were lined with nothing but white people. I was the only Black participant in this parade. People were waving and cheering and just, you know, having a good time until we reached a certain point in this parade route when suddenly, pow, I'm getting hit with bottles and soda pop cans and small debris from the street by just a small group of white spectators off to my right on the sidewalk. I remember it being a couple of kids, maybe a year or two older than me. I didn't know them. And perhaps their parents, because there were a couple of adults throwing things as well. And because I had no precedent for this behavior, My first thought was, oh, those people over there, they don't like the scouts. That's how naive I was, right? So, I mean,
most precious reaction.
So anyway, it wasn't until my troop leaders came running and they huddled over me with their own bodies. You know, these were white troop leaders, of course. And they escorted me out of the danger. Now, naturally, nobody else is getting this special protection. So I'm trying to figure out what had I done to cause these people to go off like that. You know, and I'm racking my brain and I'm asking them, what's going on? Why is this happening? And all they would do is kind of shush me and rush me along, tell me to keep moving. Everything's going to be okay. They never addressed my question. So fortunately, the people did not follow us, you know, who were throwing things, and everything, you know, ended up being okay. But when I got home at the end of the parade, my mom and dad, who were not present for the parade, were cleaning me up and putting Band-Aids on me and asking me, how did you trip and fall down and get all scraped up? And I told them, you know, exactly what happened. And for the first time in my life, my mom and dad sat me down and explained to me what racism was. Now, believe it or not, Meredith, at the age of 10, I had never heard the word racism. There was no reason for me to. It did not exist in my sphere. That's why it's so important to understand my background of having been around everybody. You know, people talk about tribalism, how people will go to their own. I was never like that because everybody was my tribe, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was my experience. And when they told me this, I literally did not believe my parents for the first time in my life. I'm an only child, so my mom and dad were very close to me. You know, they never lied to me. But on this day, I knew they were lying because it made absolutely no sense that someone who had never seen me, never spoken to me, knew nothing about me, would want to hurt me for no other reason than, you know, the color of my skin. And that's where that question came. How can you hate me when you don't even know me? And I didn't understand that. So I didn't believe them. But this was 1968, a very pivotal year in our country, you know, with civil rights and all of that. And it culminated on April 4th. 1968, of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So I began believing that this racism thing does exist, but I didn't know why. And that's how that question evolved.
Wow. I watched the MLK/FBI documentary on Amazon, which suggests that the FBI in some ways facilitated the assassination of Dr. King. Do you ever feel with all of the work that you do that the FBI like maybe has a file on you?
Oh, I'm sure they do. Yeah, I'm sure they do.
Does that freak you out?
No, because I think a lot of people have files on me because they consider me to be an oddity. You know, I'm not the status quo. But, you know, that's, hey, I have nothing to hide.
Do you feel like an oddity?
No, I feel like I'm doing what should be done.
Yeah.
You know, this is my country. I have been, between my travels with my parents as a kid and now my travels as a professional musician and lecturer, when you combine those travels, I have been to all 50 states. I have been to 63 countries on 6 continents. So what does that mean other than I have a lot of frequent flyer miles and hotel points, right? It means that I've been exposed to a wide multitude of skin colors, ethnicities, religions, cultures, ideologies, etc. And all of that has helped shape who I have become. And it bothers me a great deal. How can I go halfway around the world and be treated better by people in other countries who may not look like me, or who do look like me, or who do look like white Americans, but be treated worse in my own country? So I'm doing the right thing by trying to show people, hey, we all can get along. Unfortunately, most Americans do not travel, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. According to them, less than 50% even own passports. You know, one of my favorite quotes of all time is by Mark Twain. It's called the travel quote. Mark Twain said, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness."
Yes.
And many of our people need it sorely on these accounts. Broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime. And that is so true. Now, all that travel does not make me a better human being than someone who has had less travel. But what it does is it gives me a better understanding of humanity than someone who has not been exposed to that.
That's one of the reasons that I'm so passionate about travel, not just because it's an antidote to prejudices and small-mindedness, but I don't know. My husband likes to say I have a clinical level of FOMO. And I feel like if I can't connect with you because of something that I was indoctrinated in as a child, a prejudice or a systematic way of thinking, then that sucks for me. It doesn't just suck for you. It sucks for me. I want to know you. I want to understand you. And I want to give you the space to speak freely enough about it that you don't feel like you have to censor yourself or edit yourself. And that's kind of like the point of what I want to inspire with this show, is to allow people an opportunity to hear what does curiosity sound like, right? Because we're all on our phones anyway. But then to take that to the next level offline and implement it and experiment with it and play with it and have fun, because it's really a special thing to connect with other people. Although, not saying that all of your interactions with KKK members were like super warm and fuzzy. They definitely weren't, especially not your first one. Can you talk about the first time that you ever had an interaction with a KKK member? You didn't know it at the time, but it was kind of memorable.
Well, I finished a gig and I was probably about an hour from home. And there was an all-night restaurant not too far from the gig. And I pulled into the parking lot to get something to eat. You know, this is like around, 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. And right on the curb, on the sidewalk of the restaurant, I saw a man who was straddled across a woman lying on her back. He was sitting on her chest as I was pulling into my parking space, just maybe 30 feet away. And he was banging her head into the sidewalk and smacking her across the face. Meanwhile, there are about four other guys standing there watching this and not doing anything, just standing there watching this. And I've seen fights before. You know, I came up playing in bars, so I saw a lot of fights.
Right.
You know, and when you first start playing, you go through that kind of stuff. So anyway, I got out of my car. And I was going to go over there and pull the guy off. But as soon as I closed my car door, the slamming of the door, jolted him. He looked up and saw me looking at him. And he looked at me. He said, what are you looking at, nigger? And I said, I'm looking at you. And he goes, you want a piece of me? And I said, yeah. And he got up and he got off of her, which was, my intention in the first place. And he came at me and I literally beat the daylights out of him. And it was then. Now, he was a white guy. She was white. The four guys standing there watching were all white. And it was then that one of them went inside the restaurant and called the police. Now, they weren't calling the police when he was beating the crap out of this woman, but they called the police when I beat the crap out of him. So these two cops came, and they were county cops, Frederick County police officers.
And was this the 80s?
Yeah, this specifically, it was like 1983. And the guy had to get up off the ground and talk to them. And something was odd. I wanted the guy arrested for assault. I mean, I didn't get hurt, but he tried to assault me, which is why, I got him. And they would not arrest him. We didn't see it happen. We just got on the scene, blah, blah, blah. So, you got all these witnesses here. Well, none of the witnesses there were going to say what this guy had tried to do. So they refused to arrest him. I wanted his name, and I got all that, because they have to give that to you. So they would not arrest him. They told him to vacate the premises immediately, and if he were to set foot back on the premises within 24 hours, they would arrest him for trespassing. So he left. I went inside, got some ice and a towel, put it on this lady's head, talked to her. I said, listen, if you want to go to court against this guy, I'm happy to go there as your witness. We exchanged information. And I left. I took his name. And rather than going there and eat like I was going to, I went down to the police station, to the commissioner, and swore out a warrant for his arrest. I had all this detail. And I'm just about finishing it up. And I said, how long will it take for this thing to be served? And the commissioner said, oh, about, you know, 3 days, I'll sign it, give it to the sheriff's deputies. You know, they'll go process it and serve it. And right about then, in walks the guy that I beat up. He's handcuffed behind his back. He's got a Maryland state trooper on this side, a Maryland state trooper on that side, escorting him in. And I saw him through the big picture window in the office that I was sitting in. I said, that's him right there. That's him right there. And the commissioner said, well, go ahead and sign it and I'll serve him right now. So I signed it and he walked out there and served the guy. Long story short, because I'm wondering, you know, why is this guy being dragged in here? You know, I didn't recognize, you know, these two cops. You know, these were Maryland state troopers. The other two were Frederick County police officers. Now, county police officers, you know, they may play, but state troopers don't play. They do not play. All right. So anyway, they brought this guy in here. Turns out he left the property, you know, as I saw him leave. When the police left, he came back to find me to even the score. Couldn't find me, went inside the restaurant and picked a fight with some other black guy. So this time, I guess the state troopers were in the area and they responded. And that's why he was arrested. Okay,
oh my
so
gosh.
Skipping ahead, here comes the court date. And I called the lady and I said, hey, I'm happy to come by, pick you up and drive you to court. So I went by her house, picked her up. On, you know, she lived probably about 45 minutes away from where the court was. On the ride to the courthouse, she tells me how all of this happened. She was this guy's ex-fiance. She had dumped him because he was cheating on her. And he had a new fiance who he had gotten pregnant, right? And so she wanted nothing to do with him. He was not willing to let her go. He wanted his cake and eat it too. So if I can't have you, bam, 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 nobody will have you kind of thing, right? She tells me he's a member of the county fire department. And so that instantly told me why he didn't get arrested. The county cops and the county fire department, they all know each other. You know, so one's doing, you know, one's washing the hand of the other kind of thing, right? So they gave him a break, more or less. And the other guys standing around were firefighters. They're all, you know, they're not going to pull their buddy off some woman, you know, for whatever reason. So anyway, and then she tells me he's also a member of the Ku Klux Klan, the local Ku Klux Klan. Well, I mean, I didn't know that, but I didn't care. I didn't care if it was a Klansman or anybody else. You had no business doing this. This woman is somebody's mother, she's somebody's daughter, she's somebody's sister. You don't do things like that. So that's why I got involved. And long story short, it went to court and he was found guilty and he had to pay a fine and he had to do some weekend community service and all this kind of thing.
Wow. So how did you go from that experience to, you know what I'm going to do today? I'm going to make me a KKK friend.
Well, he never became my friend.
But I suppose not.
I did run into him. Oh, I don't know, about a year or so later. I was going to that same restaurant, right? But this is during the day to get something to eat because I was in that area. Because, you know, that, you know, it's like about an hour from my house. And when I walked in, there was a whole bank of payphones. And he was standing on the payphone facing the door. And I come walking in the door and I saw him. He saw me. He turned around and faced the payphone.
Nothing to see here.
Yeah, nothing to see here. So, oh gosh, it was probably months, maybe 6 to 8 months later. I was playing again in that area. And I was playing at an all-white bar, a lounge called the Silver Dollar Lounge. And when I say all-white, I don't mean that blacks could not go in. I mean, that blacks did not go in by their own choice. And it was a good choice because they were not welcome there. You know, there were no signs saying whites only, nothing like that. You know, like you saw back in the 50s or 60s, you know, colored water fountain, white water, nothing like that. But it had a reputation that blacks were not welcome. And, you know, when you go somewhere where you're not welcome and alcohol is being served, it's not always a good combination. I had a gig there. I joined a country band. And the place booked a lot of country bands. So, you know, country music had become popular again. And so I joined this country band. I was the only black guy in the band. They were pretty popular in the state of Maryland. And they had played there many times. So they had a gig there. Here I am in the Silver Dollar Lounge. People looked at me when I came in, but they didn't, you know, they didn't bother me. And I played the gig, played the first set, took a break, and I'm following the man over to the table to sit down, and I feel somebody come up from behind and put their arm across my shoulder. Now, I see the whole band in front of me because I'm following them to the table. So I'm you know, trying to figure out who on earth is, you know, touching me. I turn around, and this guy has this big smile on his face. He's very happy. I'm like, man, I love your all's music. And I shook his hand. You know, I ain't never seen you before, but I seen this band before. And I said, well, they played here before, but this is my first time. He goes, man, I sure love your piano playing. This is the first time I ever heard a black man play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis. Now, I'm trying to figure out what, you know, how is it? You know, this guy was at least 15, 18 years older than me. Did he not know the black origin of Jerry Lee Lewis's piano style? That rock and roll rockabilly came from black boogie woogie piano players. And I proceeded to explain that Jerry Lee and I got it from the same place. You know, black blues and boogie woogie piano players. Oh, no, no, no. I never heard no black man play like that, except for you. So I'm thinking, okay, well, the guy never heard Fats Domino or Little Richard. It's the same boogie style. And I said, look, man, Jerry Lee Lewis is a good friend of mine. He's told me himself, you know, where his influences came. Guy didn't believe that either. But he was fascinated and wanted me to go back to his table and let him buy me a drink. So I went back to his table. I don't drink alcohol, but I let him buy me a cranberry juice. He paid for it, took his glass, and he, like, clinked my glass, and he cheered me and says, you know, I mean, it's like he was, like, really proud of this proclamation. You know, this is the first time I ever sat down and had a drink with a black man. And I'm not thinking, how can this be? You know, at that point in my life, I had sat down literally with tens of thousands of white people or anybody else and had a meal, a conversation, a beverage. How is it that this guy had never done that? He's a decade and a half older than me. So innocently, I asked, I said, why? And he didn't answer me. And his buddy elbowed him and said, tell him, tell him. And I said, tell me. He says, I'm a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Well, I started laughing at him because now I didn't believe him, right? I know a lot, a whole lot about the Klan at that point. And I know they didn't just come up and embrace a black guy and want to hang out and buy him a drink and talk. So this guy is joking with me. While I'm laughing, he goes in his pocket, pulls out his wallet, goes through it, and hands me his Klan membership card. I recognize the red circle with the white cross and blood drop in the center. I'm like, whoa, this thing is for real. So I stop laughing, right? It's not funny anymore. And I give it back to him. And we talked about the Klan and some other things. But he was very, very friendly and very, very curious about me. Gave me his phone number. And wanted me to call him anytime I was to return with this band to this bar so he could bring his friends, meaning Klansmen and Klanswomen, to see, as he put it, the black guy who plays like Jerry Lee. I'm not sure he called me the black guy to his friends, right?
Right.
But that's how he that's how he explained it to me.
That was filtered down, yeah.
Right, exactly. Anyway, I call him every 6 weeks on a Wednesday or a Thursday and say, hey, man, you know, we're going to be out at the Silver Dollar this weekend. He'd show up with Klansmen and Klanswomen, not in robes and hoods, but, you know, regular street clothes. They'd come, they'd gather near the stage and watch me play. They'd get out on the dance floor and dance. And on the breaks, you know, I'd make my way over to their table, say hello, thank you for coming. And most of them would hang there and want to meet me. They were curious. There were a couple of them, every time they see me coming, they'd get up and walk to the other side of the room. So the implication was, you know, we just want to look at you. You know, we don't want to shake your hand or talk to you, which is fine. So that went on until the end of that year. And then I quit the band and I went back to playing rock and roll and whatever else was going on. Well, a few years later, it dawned on me, Daryl, you blew it. The answer to your question that has been plaguing you since the age of 10, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? It fell right into your lap and you didn't even realize it. Because I had a vast collection of books on black supremacy, white supremacy, anti-Semitism, the KKK, the Nazis in Germany, the neo-Nazis over here, racism, you name it, I got it. None of those books answered my question. And when I would ask people, you know, my answer would be, oh, Daryl, some people are just like that. That's just how they are. That's not an answer to the question. I want to know why. Why are they like that, right? So it dawned on me that the answer fell into my lap. I didn't even realize it. Who better to ask that question of, how can you hate me when you don't even know me, than to ask it of someone who would go so far as to join an organization that has over a 100-year history of practicing hating people who don't look like them or who don't believe as they believe. Get back in contact with that Klansman. You know, get him to hook you up with the Klan leader for the state of Maryland. Interview that guy. Ask him, how can he hate you? He doesn't even know you, right? And then go around the country, up north, down south, Midwest, west, and find out, you know, get interviews with other Klan leaders and members and write a book, because my book would become the first book ever written by a black author on the KKK from in-person interviews, because all the other ones were written by white authors. And that's exactly what I did.
And you did not tell them that your first interview, I remember listening in another interview that you did, that your first interview with a Klansman, I believe it was your first, you didn't tell them that you were a black man. It was right. Kind of like a surprise, see how this goes. I can only imagine the tension in the air as you were.
Well, you know, while I had, you know, I was beginning to get a name in the music industry. You know, I began working with Chuck Berry and different people. So my name was circulating in musical circles, but not in Klan circles, right? And the guy, the first guy that I met who was friendly, like in the Silver Dollar Lounge, I persuaded him to give me the address and phone number for the Klan leader from Maryland. He didn't want to do it because he was afraid he would get in trouble, I would get in trouble. He gave it to me only on the condition that I not tell the Klan leader, whose name was Roger Kelly, where I got his personal information. And so I agreed, and he gave it to me. But he warned me, he said, Daryl, do not go to Roger Kelly's house. He will kill you. And I said, well, that's why I need to see him. Why would he kill me? He doesn't even know me. He goes, Daryl, this guy genuinely liked me.
Yeah.
You know, the music had connected with him or something, right? And he was very concerned about my safety. And I'm trying to say to him, I understand that, but I need to know, I need to understand why, you know, he would do anything like this. So, you know, he gave me that warning. I said, I'll be careful. So, and then he reminded me, don't tell him where you got this information, because he didn't want to get killed or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So I decided I would have my white secretary. And the only reason I mentioned that she's white, because I could care less what color somebody is who works for me, is because I knew if I called Mr. Kelly, after all, I have the phone number, he might detect in my voice that I'm black. Because I'm not talking to you, click, mm-hmm. You know, and my whole project would have ended before it ever got started. So I figured if Mary, my secretary, called him, he would know by her voice, this is a white woman on the other end of this line. He would not even think that a white woman is working for a black man, especially a black man who's writing a book on the Klan, because they did not exist, right?
That's a very good point. In that regard, you were definitely undercover.
At that point, yes. Yes, indeed. So I was hoping that would put the odds in my favor that he would grant me the interview. So I instructed her, do not tell Mr. Kelly that I'm black. Now, if he asks, no, don't lie to him, you know, but don't give him reason to ask. Because I figured if he asked, either A, he would deny me the interview, or B, he may grant me the interview, but he might have different answers for a black interviewer than he would have for a white interviewer. So I wanted it to be candid, spontaneous. You know, it wasn't that I was trying to deceive him by any means. So she understood. She called him. He agreed to do the interview. So we set the time. We had a motel room right above the Silver Dollar Lounge. The lounge was in the bottom of this motel. So Mary and I got there early, and I gave her some money, sent her down the hallway to get soda pop out of the machine, put it in the ice bucket, get it cold. I had no idea what this man was going to do when he arrived, and he saw me. Would he say, I'm not talking to you, and turn around and leave? Or would he come in the room and do the interview? Would he attack me? I had no idea. I only knew what I was going to do. I was going to be hospitable and offer him a cold beverage, like I would offer you or anybody else coming to see me at my home or my room or whatever. So she got all that set. And just by happenstance, the way the room was situated, if you were standing in the hallway looking into the door of the motel room, you cannot see who's in the room because there's a wall there. You got to come in, walk around the corner, and there's the room. So I took the little lamp table, took the lamp off, and put the table in the most obscure corner of the room. Put a chair on one side for Mr. Kelly, a chair on the other side for me. And I had a little bag that contained a Bible and a recorder. And I put the recorder on the table, all in hopes that if Mr. Kelly did come in the room, he would allow me to record our interview. And I had, why did I have the Bible? Because the Ku Klux Klan claims to be a Christian organization. Not the Christians that I know, you know, or that I practice, but I wanted to, you know, find out, because they believe the Bible preaches racial separation. So I wanted to be able, you know, pull out my Bible and say, here, Mr. Kelly, please, you know, show me chapter and verse where it says blacks and whites must be separate. So I'm all prepared, right? Right on time, right to the minute. Knock, knock, knock on the door. I'm seated over there where you can't see me from the doorway. You got to come in. Mary hops up, runs around the corner, opens the door. In walks the bodyguard. He's wearing camouflage military stuff with that Ku Klux Klan patch, the red circle, white cross, blood drop over here on his chest, the letters KKK on this side, Knights of the Ku Klux Klan embroidered on his cap, and a semi-automatic handgun on his hip. He comes in, comes around the corner, and sees me and just freezes. Well, Mr. Kelly is on the other side of the corner and doesn't realize that his bodyguard has stopped short. He comes around the corner and boom, hits the guy in the back, knocks him forward, and now they both are stumbling around, looking all around the room, you know. And I'm just sitting at the table, you know, looking at them, and I can read their faces. They're thinking, did we misunderstand the room number, or is this an ambush?
right.
So I stood up and I went like this to show I had nothing in my hands, and I walked forward. I said, "Hi, Mr. Kelly. I'm Daryl Davis." He shook my hand, as did the bodyguard. So far, so good. Please, come on in. Have a seat. Mr. Kelly sat down, and the bodyguard stood at attention on his right side. And right before I could sit down, Mr. Kelly asked me if I had any identification. I said, sure. I give him my driver's license. And he says, oh, you live on such and such street. And I said, yes. And that, you know, had me like, why is he reading my street? Is he going to come to my house and burn a cross? You know, what's up? But I want to let him know that don't pay me any, you know, unwarranted or uninvited visit. My knowledge. And I said, yes, Mr. Kelly, that is where I live and you live at. And I named his address. You know, so I'm leveling the playing field. You know, you come visit me, I will come visit you. So we're going to keep all this visiting confined to this hotel room, right? And so he smiled and nodded his head like he understood. I did not realize it that day. I found out months later. I had no reason to be concerned about Mr. Kelly coming to my house uninvited. A, he wasn't that kind of person. But the reason why he mentioned my street name is because one of his members lived right down the road here. My street out here runs through a couple neighborhoods, and this Klan member lived a couple neighborhoods down. I did not know that. Mr. Kelly had to come on my street in order to get to that guy's house. So it was just pure coincidence. I had no way of knowing that at the time. Today, that same member sits in a federal prison in the state of Maine for a hate crime. Anyway, so we got on with this interview. And every time Mr. Kelly would say, Mr. Davis, the Bible says, I'd reach down, pull out my Bible and say, here, Mr. Kelly, show me chapter and verse exactly where it says that. Or my thing ran out of recording cassettes. I'd reach down and get a fresh cassette. Every time I reached down like this, the Nighthawk reached up like this, you know, and he never pulled his gun. He just, you know, rested his hand on the butt of the gun. I understood that. That's his job. You know, I'm the enemy. I'm the black guy. He doesn't know what's in my bag. So his job is to protect his boss. So he's doing his job. I got that. So after about 45 minutes of me reaching down, him reaching up, he finally relaxed and realized there was no threat in the bag. I went in and out of the bag. Bodyguard didn't move. A little over an hour into this interview, Mr. Kelly and I are just talking casually, and out of nowhere, there was this very fast, very short noise, like a ch-ch-ch. That was it. It was over. But it was so out of context, we all jumped. Like, what was that? And I jumped up out of my chair, and I hit the table, you know, leaning in Mr. Kelly's direction. The noise was so short and so fast that my ear could not discern what it was. So I perceived it to be an ominous, threatening kind of noise. I couldn't figure it out. But what I did know was I didn't make it. So if I didn't make it, Mr. Kelly had to have made it. And why was he making some weird noise? And all I could hear in the back of my head was, Daryl, don't fool with Roger Kelly. He will kill you, from that other guy, right? So I had gone into survival mode. When you fear for your life, you will do anything and everything to preserve yourself. And there are only a few things you can do. Some people, they just pass out. They faint because the fear is so great, the brain can't process it and it shuts down and they just pass out. I don't do that. Other people, their muscles will constrict and they'll ball up and start shaking and they can't loosen themselves. You know, that's called paralysis by fear. I don't do that either. Another thing people will do is to run away from the fear. That is the best option. And that is the option that I would have chosen. As quickly as you can, separate yourself from the source of the fear. Get away from it. All right. How am I going to outrun a bullet in a motel room? That was not an option for me. I'm not armed. Mary is not armed. The only person I know for sure who is armed is the bodyguard. I see his gun on his hip. I don't know if Mr. Kelly's wearing a suit and tie. I don't know if he had a weapon up under his suit and tie or not. All I know is I don't have a gun and I cannot outrun a bullet, right?
And you're in a hotel room.
I'm in a hotel room, exactly. So your last option is to do what's called a preemptive strike. Get them before they get you. And when I flew out of my chair, I was on my way to dive across that table and grab the bodyguard, grab Mr. Kelly, and slam them down to the ground and disarm the bodyguard and neutralize the situation. Because my job is to protect myself and my secretary. Just like I was going to go over there and get that guy off that woman in the parking lot that night. You know, I'm not going to let anything happen to Mary, let alone myself. The bodyguard's job is to protect himself and his boss. So that's where I was going. And I'm looking right into Mr. Kelly's eyes. I didn't say a word to him, but I could read his eyes, you know, and I knew he could read my eyes. My eyes were saying to him, what did you just do? His eyes were saying to me, what did you just do? And the bodyguard had his hand back on his gun, looking at both of us like, what did either one of y'all just do? Well, Mary was sitting to my left on top of the dresser, and because there were no more chairs in the room, and she realized what had happened. The ice bucket with the cans of soda was sitting next to her, and the ice had begun melting, and the cans of soda were like falling down the ice. So going, you know, and it happened again while she was explaining it to us, and we all began laughing.
Oh my gosh.
We all began laughing at how ignorant we all were. But this was a teaching moment. I won't say a learning moment, but a teaching moment. Learning would come later. And the lesson taught was all because some foreign, and I always say underscore, circle, highlight the word foreign, entity of which we were ignorant, that being the foreign entity would be the bucket of ice with the cans of soda, because we were not thinking about it, had entered into our little comfort zone, we became fearful and accusatory of each other. Ignorance breeds fear. We fear those things that we don't understand, those things of which we are ignorant. All right? If you don't address that ignorance or that fear will then escalate into hatred because we hate the things that frighten us. Mm-hmm. Say, for example, when you were a kid, maybe you didn't like roller coasters. Why? They scare me. The fear causes you to hate something. Or someone says, hey, you want to go see the snakes? Oh, I hate snakes. I'm afraid of snakes. You know, the fear causes the hatred, right? If you don't address that hatred, that in turn will escalate into destruction. You want to destroy the things that you hate. Why? Because they frighten you. But guess what? At the end of the day, they may have been harmless and you were simply ignorant. So fortunately, that whole chain of events stopped short of the destruction when Mary began explaining things to us.
So ignorance, fear, hatred, and then
destruction.
Destruction. Hey, Curiositors, just a quick pause to show gratitude to our sponsors and give you some special deals. My husband and I have been using Liquid IV since 2019. We love that you put it in cold water and it actually dissolves and, you know, tastes awesome. Lately, strawberry lemonade flavor has been my go-to. They also have sugar-free now. And in just one stick, I get 5 essential vitamins and hydrated 2 times faster than water alone. Get 20% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use code CURIOUS at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code CURIOUS at liquidiv.com. When I started listening to podcasts, I could never find the one go-to show. They were either too self-helpy or too bro-y until I found the Jordan Harbinger Show. Honestly, I feel like it's a sister show to my show. If you like my show, you are 100% gonna love his. Some of my favorite episodes include the one with the man held hostage by Somali pirates, episode 115, and the one with the pain psychologist about how pain lives in the brain, not the body, episode 661. But you can also download a starter pack of episodes by going to jordanharbinger.com/start. And Jordan himself, super interesting. He's a recovering Wall Street attorney who speaks 5 languages, was kidnapped twice, and used to run a tour company that took Westerners to North Korea. Yeah, you like it already, don't you? I told you you would. You can't go wrong with adding the Jordan Harbinger Show to your rotation. It's incredibly interesting. There's never a dull show. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Spring has sprung, but so have the mosquitoes, and that can be a real buzzkill. See what I did there? I've been using Insect's mosquito service since 2019, and they continue to impress me. They guarantee their work, and pollinators are always top of mind. Don't wait till the last minute to get on their schedule. If you're in the Florida Panhandle or the Gulf Coast of Alabama, give Insect a call, ensec.net. The Florida Panhandle isn't just the home of your favorite podcaster. That's me, by the way. Shameless, I know. But it's also a go-to spot for a lot of families on vacation. Don't plan a Pensacola trip without getting tickets to the UWF Historic Trust. It's good for a whole week, and it's a great indoor activity option. You'll recognize Trader John's, where I record the show in the Pensacola Museum of History. Get your tickets in person so you can show the agent one of my emails and get $2 off an adult ticket. HistoricPensacola.org. Now back to the show. Remember to stay till the end, where I give you a sneak peek of next week's episode. When I think about all of the times that you've had these these moments with Klansmen, the opportunity that you created to help dismantle their ignorance and thus prevent more of the fear, hatred, and destruction, I think about how most people are not card-carrying KKK members, right? And most people wouldn't openly share with their friends or even their like closest family that they believe that Black people are genetically inferior in any way or prone to violence or drug use, etc. These are all specifics I'm taking out of your conversations with Klansmen. But it could be true that a lot of people have similar biases against Black people that are less articulated even to themselves in their own minds. So how do we have conversations with each other to undo the ignorance that feeds that hatred if the beliefs that we have are left unarticulated, even within ourselves, and the ones that we could articulate, we don't, for fear of cancellation and backlash?
Excellent question. Somebody has to take that step forward. Somebody has to be the first to talk to the elephant in the room. And I look at it like this. Our society, our country, can only become one of two things. One, it can become that which we sit back and watch it become. Or two, it can become that which we stand up and make it become. So we have to ask ourselves the question, do I want to sit back and see what my country becomes? Or do I want to stand up and make it become what I want to see? All right? So I encourage everybody to walk what I call walk across the cafeteria. It can be done physically. It can be done virtually. All right. Like you and I are doing right now across the internet. Right. You know, you see these metropolitan cities or whatever that are, you know, pretty diverse. schools are diverse, companies are diverse, and people, you know, are working together perhaps on the same project. They might even be sharing the same cubicle. But what happens at 12 noon? Everybody goes downstairs to the cafeteria to eat lunch. But what happens there? People self-segregate. Blacks sit with blacks. Hispanics sit with Hispanics. This group sits with this group, you know? Does that mean that they are racist? No. People tend to feel more comfortable around familiarity, people who share something in common, whether it's a language, whether it's a type of dress, you know, national attire or whatever, language. So walk across the cafeteria. Leave your comfort group at lunch once or twice a week and go sit at somebody else's table. Now, if the people at the other table say, you don't belong here, go back to your own table. Yes, there's a problem and it needs to be addressed. But chances are they won't do that. You sit at their table, you have a lot to learn from them. You have a lot to teach them as well. And in the process, you will most likely make a good friend. And you will learn things that you have never learned before, never considered before. You know, look at medicine. You know, 20, 25 years ago, insurance companies would not pay for acupuncture. Like, how do you stick a needle in somebody's foot and fix a pain in their shoulder? You know, it was just unheard of in our culture. Today, they do pay for it. They pay for a lot of Eastern culture type of medical procedures, all right? So we all have a lot to share with each other. And these are the things, you know, that I've learned from traveling around the world, that everybody, no matter how far I've gone from the United States, whether it's right next door to Canada or right next door to Mexico or halfway around the globe, no matter how different people may be that I encounter, perhaps they don't look like I look, they don't speak my language or worship as I do, or maybe not even worship at all. I always conclude one thing. Everybody I've met is a human being, regardless of how different or how similar our cultures or belief systems may be. And as such, every human being in the world wants these five core values in their lives. Everybody wants to be loved. Everybody wants to be respected. We all want to be heard. We want to be treated fairly and truthfully. And we want the same things for our family as anybody else wants for their family. And if we can learn to apply those five core values when we find ourselves in an adversarial situation or a culture or society in which we are unfamiliar or uncomfortable, it doesn't even have to be about race. It could be any hot topic. Let's say, for example, abortion, nuclear weapons, global warming, the upcoming presidential election, the past presidential election. You're on one side, somebody else is on the other side. Apply those five core values and you will have a more civil conversation, a more productive and a more positive conversation. You know, so that's what I apply. And walking across the cafeteria, you know, if you work for a company and your company does business with some other company in some other state or some other country, call up your counterpart and say, hey, let's set up a time that we can chat after work. And just, you know, get to know, how many kids do you have? You know, what do they do? What are you interested in besides working at this company? Get to know one another. That's all you got to do. Our country is so rich in diversity, but we don't take advantage of it. You know, for me to have gone to these 63 countries, I had to cross the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean numerous times. Like I said before, most Americans don't travel. But you know what? Today, you don't have to cross those oceans to meet somebody. You can do it like right now as you and I are talking over the internet. We can talk to people in Africa, in China, in Australia. So let's do that. How is it that we can talk to people anywhere on the face of this earth? We can even talk to people live who are walking around on the moon via satellite radio phone, right? But we can't talk to somebody who lives right next door, who works with us in our company or is in class with us in school, just because of the color of their skin or their religion or their persuasion. So it seems to me a missed opportunity for conversation is a missed opportunity for reconciliation.
I could not have said that better. In your interview with Rob Lowe, you called looking honestly at our country's history, turning over all the cards face up. And I just, correct, I love the visual that that makes in my brain. I wanted to ask you how you see that playing out in a practical way in our educational system and our public school system in a way that isn't happening right now? Like, what changes would you like to see so that kids are growing up seeing all of the cards on the table?
Okay. Every country, every person has history. And, you know, if you're young, you'll get some eventually. We all have the good, the bad, the ugly, and the shameful. And unfortunately, we tend to omit the ugly, the shameful, and the bad. Or we tone it down. We rewrite it. We revision it. I went to one of the two best high school systems in the country, Montgomery County, Maryland. We did not learn in the 1970s. I graduated high school in 76 and college in 1980. In public high schools in Montgomery County, and like so many all across the country, did not teach in history class that we had internment camps in this country for Japanese Americans. I did not learn that until college. And when I learned that in college, I was incredulous. Like, no way. And my teacher said, yes way. And I asked my parents. My parents said, yes. Like, why wasn't this in the history books? Because it was shameful what we did to those people. They were as American as you and I or anybody else, right? So now today, it is in the history books. You might have learned it. If you have kids, they will learn it, all right? Today, the Tulsa race riots are not in the history books. Emmett Till is not in the history books. I learned about that 30 years ago because my parents taught it to me.
I learned about it 2 years ago. Like, I'm still learning things all the time, and which makes me go, gosh, wouldn't our future look a little bit better if we could just trust that kids can handle a more complete version of history? Like in one of your interviews, you were talking about how President Warren G. Harding was sworn into the Ku Klux Klan in the green room in the White House. Like, correct. I think that's a pretty important piece of information because it paints the whole picture. You know, we tend to put our historical leaders up on these pedestals and make them, you know, demigods in a way. And I don't think that's helpful. I don't think they would have wanted that either. And so it's like, how do we create a better future if we're not teaching a more complete version of the past?
You said something very, very important. And in a sense, you answered your own question. You might not have realized it. You said, why do they think that, you know, kids cannot handle this? It's not that they think kids cannot handle this. They know kids can handle anything, all right? It's that they don't want the embarrassment themselves, the guilt that they did not teach it way back when. That's what it is. Kids can handle it. There was a TV show called American Bandstand, and it started in the 1950s and ran through the 70s and stuff, where, you know, different artists would come and play. It was the biggest music show on TV. So on the 25th anniversary, usually 20th or 25th in the 1970s, the host of the show, a guy named Dick Clark, had all these stars from the 50s and 60s return, and he played clips of them on the show in black and white singing their hit song. And halfway through the song, the star would walk out from behind the curtain live and finish the song, you know, 20 years later, right, in color. And Dick Clark would walk across the stage at the end of the song. And if it was a guy, shake their hand. If it was a woman, you know, kiss her. And all the stars, the white stars, he would kiss on the lips, right? The black female star, well, the female stars, all the white female stars, he would kiss on the lips. All the black female stars, you would see him walk and get ready to kiss them on the lips. The camera would pan. So he would kiss them on the lips, but you wouldn't see it. The camera would pan to the audience and then come back after the kiss was over. Because they didn't want to show a white man kissing a black female on TV. The first interracial kiss on TV was between Captain Kirk and Lieutenant Uhura on the original Star Trek. And do you remember a TV show called The Jeffersons?
I do.
Okay, so George and his wife Louise, you know, were always fighting over George spending money or doing something stupid. And they would be, you know, lying in the same bed. Now, back in the 50s, we had TV shows like Leave It to Beaver and whatever. The husband and wife on the TV shows slept in separate beds, okay? Even though they didn't in real life. They slept in your mom and dad didn't sleep in separate beds. Neither did my mom and dad, right? Okay, but they're not going to show that on TV back then. So now you're into the 70s, and they're showing George and Louise sleeping in the same bed and arguing over something stupid George had done. The upstairs neighbors, Tom and Helen, Tom was a white man married to Helen, a black woman, and they always argued as well. But you would see them dressed and in the living room arguing. You would never see Tom and Helen in the bed together, even though they were married. And why? Because the TV executives said the public would not handle that. It's not that the public couldn't handle it. It's that these racist people did not want the guilt and did not want to show that kind of thing. And that's why we're dealing with it today. Why books are being banned and our history is being banned. My history is your history. Your history is my history. We all are here together. And one of the things that is happening, Meredith, that the media does not talk about, and if you doubt me, look it up. I learned this in 1982. All right? What's that? 42 years ago or something, right? I learned it from the head of the American Nazi Party. He told me a lot of lies, but this one thing he told me was true. They are very, very concerned about the year 2042. When I was a child, I'm 66 now, as I said before, the black population in this country was 12%, Native Americans, 1%, Latino, Hispanic Americans, 2%, Asian Pacifica Americans, 3%, whites, 86, 87%. Over the years, this is happening. Our census is taken every decade, all right? In the year 2042, this country will be this. 50% white, 50% non-white. Between 2045 and 2050, it's going to flip. And for the first time, whites will become the minority in this country. There is a vast number of white people who say, I don't care. What's the big deal? This evolution doesn't bother me. But then there is a large slice of our population that does care. And those are the ones that I deal with. And, you know, and they tell me, Daryl, I don't want my grandkids to be brown. They call it the browning of America, or white genocide through miscegenation, race mixing. And they're very concerned about that. And that's why we're seeing an increase in these lone wolves who are going into synagogues, into church, black churches, into the Buffalo grocery store. The incident in Jacksonville, Florida, a couple months ago. The Walmart in El Paso. And shooting up people who are non-white. They're trying to stop this increase, and they're calling for what they call RAHOWA, R-A-H-O-W-A, RAHOWA, which are the first two letters of these three words, racial holy war, RAHOWA, okay? And for short, they call it the race war.
Hmm.
And I learned this in 1982, and we're seeing all of this come. You know, when I first started doing this work, back 40-some years ago, there was the Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis, and white power skinheads. That was it. Today, you got neo-Nazis, KKK, white power skinheads, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, the 1%ers, the 3%ers, the Patriot Front, the Vanguard, the National Alliance, on. And they're all saying, come join us. You know, we're going to take our country back, you know. And people, out of fear of being erased, their identity being erased, because they're of the mindset, and they truly believe this, this is a white man's country. We discovered this country. We wrote the Constitution. And now people are coming in here who don't look like us and moving us out. You know, they truly believe that they have to save the country. So they're running and joining these groups to take our country back. And when the group fails to take the country back in a timely manner, some of these people get, you know, antsy and say, you know what? If the Klan can't do it, I'll do it myself. And that's when they walk into the black church or the synagogue and start shooting up people.
Hmm. Yeah, we've got to change it. We've got to educate the young people so that they know, and then they're not afraid, and then there's no hate and no destruction, as you
exactly
so eloquently put it. Thank you so much for sharing your time with me today.
My pleasure.
I could spend hours with you. I
swear. Let's do it another time.
I would love that. That's the perfect segue, because I would love to invite you back when your new book is out. So tell everyone what they can expect in the next year or two.
Okay, sure. The original book came out in 1997 called Clandestine Relationships, spelled with a K. It's out of print now. Do not go on Amazon or eBay and try to purchase it. because there are some booksellers that still have copies of Clandestine Relationships. But because it's out of print, greed sets in and they jack up the prices really high. So don't spend that kind of money on my book, all right? Go to your public library and you can check it out and read it for free. Or you can wait for my new book, which will be out this year. The working title is The Klan Whisperer. And it will have almost everything from the first book, plus updates, plus new stories. The first book, as I said, came out in 1997. And since then, we've had a lot of changes. We've had a black president, Barack Obama. We've had more immigration. We've had Donald Trump. We've had the insurrection. We've had a lot of things that have fueled this supremacy and polarization and divisiveness in this country. So the new book will cover all of that and update you on the people from the old book.
Oh, yes, that sounds fantastic. And I would absolutely love to have you back to talk more. Thank you again. This was incredible.
Thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, you'll also like the one I did with the man who voted for Obama and then joined the KKK. It's episode 134. Stay tuned next week when I talk with a confidence therapist as we explore the idea that confidence could be an outside job.